politics, the bush, and the future of our regions. You're listening to Weatherboard and Iron with Barnaby Joyce and Matt Canavan.
Well, welcome back to another episode of Weatherboard and Iron. We're also going live on Facebook at the moment as well, at the Cassowary Coast Independent News. I'm up here in Tully, out on the road, out of Canberra. It's great to be out of Canberra, and I'm here with Peter Reid. Peter, tell our listeners about yourself.
I used to be a Great Barrier Reef scientist who used to work at James Cook University for about 35 years, sort of an expert on sediment movement and movement of water on the reef. And I was fired a couple of years ago because I didn't agree with some of the orthodoxy on the reef, and also I thought some of the scientific organisations had insufficient quality assurance for us to trust their work.
Well, in a way, we're kind of related. We've got a bit of feedback there. I'll get rid of that. But we're kind of we have something in common because I've changed jobs. I sacked myself a few weeks ago, so we've both taken pay cuts, but yours might be a bit more terms at least.
Mine was 100%, yours I think would be about 50%.
About 50, something like that.
Probably fairly similar. Yeah.
So, but we've both got more time on our hands. You're doing lots of things. But just before we move on, you've been working on the reef, what, since the mid-1980s? And you come from up here?
I'm a North Queensland. I'm actually a POM originally, but I grew up in Innisfail, north of where we are now. And I worked basically my whole scientific career on the reef.
Right, and you grew up, going swimming around here. Yep. Did you get out to the reef much when
you were a kid?
Or did
you a little bit, not as
means
not,
to
not,
do that,
or yeah. not hugely, yeah. but certainly my wife comes from Tully and all these sorts of things.
So what made you go into it? Why did you go into reef science? What was your passion?
It was actually unlike most people who go into reef science, marine biology wasn't a thing for me.
Right,
I'm a physicist. And surprisingly, there's a lot of physics in marine science. Mm. And I sort of ended up in it a bit by accident. But actually, it's quite important, that physics background, because it means that I'm not terribly emotional about the reef. I think it's beautiful. But like most marine biologists, from the age of about five, they've loved fish and they've loved the idea of snorkeling and scuba diving amongst the coral. And they tend to be quite emotional about the reef. And that is actually a problem. When you want to make sure the science is actually reliable.
Explain those physics to me. Is that the sort of the movement of sediment, suspension of solids, those kinds of things? All physical relationships.
That's right. The movement of water, how the water flushes in and out that of the reef, that affects pollutant buildup. We designed the first instruments to measure sediment movements on the reef, and we had more of those measurements than any other group put together. So those are the sorts of things. Tides, even bleaching, the way the ocean heats up, those are all physics, in fact.
Okay. All right, well, look, you've certainly had a lot to say about it. One of the reasons I'm up here at the moment and talking to you is that I'm getting prepared for, in a couple of weeks, we'll have a Senate inquiry. Last year, you came down to Canberra with a delegation of concerned farmers across North Queensland, across different industries, cane, cattle, I think some banana growers as well were there. Explain to me, how did you get involved in that? Why have you become the one of the few people defending farmers in this country?
Well, it became increasingly obvious that a lot of the scientific evidence supposedly claiming that farmers are killing the reef was just wrong, and that we needed some form of better quality assurance on that. So I was very interested in pushing that idea, and a lot of the farmers could also see that a lot of the scientific evidence against them was totally wrong. And as you sort of mentioned, when I sort of had a bit more time on my hands after I was fired, it gave me the opportunity to do these things rather than teaching students and running PhD projects and that type of stuff. So it actually released me in some way. It gave me a freedom which I didn't otherwise have.
Another thing we have in common, Peter, I've been released to a certain degree as well. So when you came down last year and we had a number of meetings, we had a discussion about what we could do. We'll turn in a second to some of the issues, substantive issues. But one thing we thought is, well, let's try and get to the bottom of this.
Yeah.
The Australian Senate, sometimes people question why it's there. But one of the things it can do is run inquiries. It can force people to come along, but usually that's not necessary. People come along and under oath, under being witnesses, they have to give true and proper evidence. So now we're going to have a Senate inquiry into, we have got a Senate inquiry into the science behind the agricultural impact on the reef. So explain to me, what's your involvement in that, and what's happening in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I'll be giving evidence to that. I mean, I'll be actually giving some of the quite interesting science about that. For example, we're going to be able to put out there in front of the senators that actually mud, which is supposedly comes from cane farms and kills the reef, actually never reaches the reef.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be able to pull out information, say, about pesticides, which are in such small concentrations on the reef that they're actually mostly unmeasurable, even with the most amazing scientific equipment. You know, they're less than parts per trillion level. These are the sorts of information which we're going to be able to get out there. And hopefully, I'm hoping we may be able to demonstrate that a lot of the so-called science, the faulty evidence that's coming out of the scientific institutions, really needs to be properly checked so that we can genuinely make good decisions about the reef.
Mm.
One of the things in Queensland is that the state government has just brought out new legislation greatly restricting the sugar, the cattle, bananas up in North Queensland. In fact, virtually every industry in North Queensland is affected by the new state legislation. Mm. And in my view, it is based on faulty, unreliable science, which doesn't mean it's all wrong. It's just that we're not really sure what is right and what is wrong. We need to do that.
Well, yeah, as I said, I'll be back up here in a couple of weeks. And with that Senate inquiry, we've got hearings in Brisbane on the 17th, Townsville on the 18th of March, and Cairns on the 19th of March. We've been here talking to cane growers this afternoon, and people need to get along. If they're concerned about this, they need to come along. Thank you for being involved. But the main message here today is come along to these hearings and have your voice heard. Now, I did want to get to some of those particular issues. As a senator interested in these issues, I've read a lot of the Great Barrier Reef Outlook reports before, some of the AIMS work, CSIRO work. And one thing that they commonly mention is that there's an issue of water quality in the Great Barrier Reef, and that is often linked back primarily, the impression I get at least is that's coming from sediment runoff. The water quality issues is a result of the runoff of sediment. It comes out through the rivers mainly during flood events.
Yep.
A lot of that sediment in there, and the impression I get, they think, is from farms. What is your what's your perspective on those issues of water quality in the Great Barrier Reef and how that impacts corals?
Well, my view is that the effect of farming is negligible. It's not just sediment. It's sediment, fertiliser and pesticides. And we can go through them one by one. But the first thing that people have to remember is the Great Barrier Reef is a very long way from the coast. And in fact, the effect of the rivers more or less almost never reaches the reef itself. It reaches some of the very, very tiny reefs close inshore. They call them the inshore reefs, but it's a very small fraction of the coral. But say my work on sediments, which we know over 25 years, in fact, the amount of sediment that hits the reef directly from the river plumes is about 1% of the amount that the inshore reefs see naturally due to resuspension of mud from the bottom due to waves stirring up the bottom. That's actually a far bigger effect. Pesticides, as I said before, it's just in negligible concentrations on the reef. Even the effect of nutrients, which supposedly causes crown of thorns starfish. The funny thing is that the worst outbreak of crown of thorns starfish, the most longest and most persistent, is on the Swains Reef, which are the furthest from the land, you know, 200 kilometres
down
from the land.
Down my way, where I live.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And there's no possibility that they're affected by agriculture. Mm. And yet they have one of the most persistent outbreaks of crown of thorns, which in my view are almost certainly an entirely natural phenomenon.
Well, can we just step through? I just wanted to go back to the sediment issue and explain, you know, I've read a lot of your work as well as the CSIROs, etc. There's a difference here between the inshore reefs and then the Great Barrier Reef that you're mentioning off the coast.
That's
so
right.
My understanding is that the Great Barrier Reef, the large part of the reef really, is much more impacted by the flows from the Pacific Ocean than the flows from the river from inland. Is that broadly true?
That's right. I mean, the Great Barrier Reef itself is affected by, it sees the Pacific Ocean in massive quantities. The inshore reef sees, the rivers a little bit. To put it in perspective, there's massive amounts of Pacific Ocean water flushes in and out of the reef. There's the same amount of water comes in from the Pacific Ocean in just 8 hours, in and out, as all the rivers in the whole Queensland coast in a whole year.
Right.
So there's these massive ocean currents that you can call them rivers of ocean water, and this actually is what's determining the water.
And where's that coming? That's coming from out of the Pacific Islands. Yeah. Also. So that comes in from east to west.
That's right. Coral sea, mostly from east to west, and some of it then goes towards the north, some of it comes to the south. But it's huge quantities of water, and it's sparkling, beautiful, clear water. One of the things that just amazes me is that we've managed to convince the whole world that the reef is completely, you know, stuffed, and that the water is brown and all the rest of it. And nothing could be further from the truth.
It's when you go out to these parts of the
reef. Yeah, the water is just incredible, and the, you know, it's really just not affected from the land at all.
So then we go to these inshore reefs, which, I mean, how far would they typically be from the coastline?
Well, they're generally right up to the coast, to within just a few kilometres from the coast, whereas the Great Barrier Reef is generally, you know, 50 to 100 kilometres from the coast.
So these inshore reefs, and some of those are still visited as I don't know this precise the precise definition, but say the reefs around the Keppel Islands.
The Keppels are inshore reefs.
Inshore reefs, so I visit them regularly.
And they're beautiful.
They are beautiful, and the Keppels are a great place to go and visit. It'd be great to have more infrastructure there, but that's a whole other episode. Those inshore reefs, you said, so they're obviously, they do get impacted by the runoff from rivers.
That they get affected to some extent.
But you're saying that the sediment that falls, or is that the right word, falls on those inshore reefs, 99% of that is from the reef suspension, effectively from waves, is that right?
That's right. So when it blows a southeasterly trade winds, very strongly, usually a couple of days, a fortnight, the waves from that stir up the bottom, makes the water go brown, and that sediment will move around. If you have a cyclone, the numbers are just astronomical. Yeah. You know, unbelievable. The amount of sediment that comes down the rivers is just nothing compared with what gets suspended due to a cyclone. The cyclones are the big effects.
And they affect the Great Barrier Reef too, the cyclones.
Well, to some extent, though, yeah. I mean, the main effect of cyclones on the reef is they just smash the coral.
Yeah.
And that's been going on for, thousands of years. But say if you look at the Keppels, they occasionally are affected by, and it kills the coral, the river runoff, but it gets killed by the fresh water. Because the one thing that a coral really doesn't like is fresh water. It can actually tolerate quite a lot of sediment. I mean, I've worked on these inshore reefs where they'll go for a whole fortnight where there is zero light on the seabed. The water is so muddy from the reef suspension, there's no light whatsoever. So the corals can generally tolerate this without any problems at all.
Fresh non-saline water
total death sentence.
And that's what Dr. Alison Jones makes this point in her submission, I think. She is based down there near the Keppels. Right. And that obviously happened quite a lot in the Fitzroy, quite large volumes down there.
Yeah, so every 4 or 5 years the Fitzroy would flood, and in a really big event it will kill the corals around the Keppels, but they'll grow back. They always have been. The other thing to remember about a reef is that it's actually a small flat top hill a couple of kilometres across, about 100 metres high, and it's made of dead coral, right? That's been killed over the last, over the history of that reef. The reef actually builds up on the bodies of dead coral. Right. We must expect coral to die. It has to die to form the reef.
Because a living organism, and that's
sort of, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So moving on to things like pesticides, or I might start with nitrogen.
Yeah.
There's this, in the Queensland legislation, and I've seen in other documents, this target of reducing nitrogen 60% by 2035.
Yep.
Where's that come from? What's the reason for that number?
It's really just made up. Right. It really is just made up. The actual effect of nitrogen is very marginal. There's 100 times more nitrogen that cycles across the seabed than comes down all the rivers, right? So the effect of the rivers on the nitrogen...
Is that from that reef suspension? There's nitrogen in the
seabed? Partly. Right. Not entirely.
Right.
There are other natural phenomena going on there. So there's massive amounts of nitrogen cycling anyway. The farmers contribute 1%. You can cut it in half and it's still, negligible. So they're really just making these numbers up in many cases. And in fact, when you look at some of these targets, even if some of these farm... In some of the districts, if the farmers totally went out of business, they still would not be able to get down to these so-called targets because of what's naturally coming down the rivers.
So that would be in their computer models. If you put the set the computer model parameters to say there's no farming, there's no nitrogen use.
Yeah, you could. Still wouldn't get for some parameters in some rivers, right. You could certainly do that.
Well, we'll get to the bottom of that during the inquiry, I'm sure. What about the I've seen some extra things about pharmaceutical use now being in like.
Oh, yes.
And that's presumably, we're moving on from farms here, obviously.
Yeah, but look, the pharmaceuticals just shows you just how ridiculous some of this so-called science is. That in these outlook reports and things, they say that pharmaceuticals are a medium risk to the Great Barrier Reef. And when you actually look at this, pharmaceuticals is when you take a Panadol for your headache and you go to the loo, it goes to the sewage treatment plant. And it doesn't all get broken down. It supposedly goes out to the reef and is a medium risk. But when you actually look at this so-called scientific evidence, they didn't actually measure it on the reef because there was no possibility that they could measure it in the tiny concentrations. They only measured it virtually entirely on the outlet pipe of the sewage treatment plant on the coast and then took no account of all the dilution
that could occur.
No, so, I mean, this is an example of where we have scientists who have really... frankly just lost the plot in that case. I mean, some of the threats are, you know, they're sort of a reasonable thing to investigate, but this was just ridiculous, and to say it was a medium risk.
I want to move on to, you've raised a few issues that there's been I suppose not just politicians potentially misusing the science and setting targets, and you know, with I'm well used as a politician but with that governments like to set a target.
So I
realise often that target's not going to necessarily come out at you from a scientific paper. It's going to be a number that a government picks, like net zero emissions, let's say, by 2050. You've also raised questions, though, about the underlying quality sometimes, and in your words, replication, the ability to repeat a scientific experiment here. In your submission inquiries, there's an interesting example, again, not involving farming, but around a paper about the idea that coal dust had made it to the reef.
Yes, that's right.
And it seemed to be a pretty open and shut case, and an error had been made with some formulas, by the look of it, or the interpretation of some formulas.
Yep.
And that was admitted to by some people. I'll let you talk about it.
And then
it hasn't been fixed.
It's never been fixed. So what we have a major problem with essentially the reliability of a lot of the so-called science. And this was a cold. What happened was that a scientist looked at the Hay Point coal terminal, and to see if coal dust was blowing off the reef, blowing off the loaders onto the reef, and they claimed it was going over 200 kilometres away onto the reef, which is crazy. Anyway, a group of CSIRO scientists looked at this and said, "Look, they've completely stuffed up. Actually, they're out by 3,000%. That's how bad it was." And they pointed it out to these scientists. The data was from the Australian Institute of Marine Science. The journal never fixed it up. The institution has never looked into it. And this work now goes into the
Who was the institution?
The data was taken by the Australian Institute of Marine Science. The scientists...
Is the problem with the data or the interpretation?
The interpretation was done by a scientist who was at James Cook University, effectively.
Okay.
But major institutions in terms of the Great Barrier, and it's just completely wrong. It's the only way, it's not just that they made a terrible mistake; it's that they never ever fixed it up when it was pointed out to them.
Right. Yeah, we all make mistakes, right?
Yes,
everybody
exactly.
makes
yeah,
mistakes.
Right.
I've made plenty, but the main thing is to own up and fix them. You told me recently that there's been another example where I think you said seven international scientists have looked at a number of papers, I think, produced by James Cook University, and all were found to have issues
with them. That's right, yes.
Maybe you could just explain that a little bit.
So one of the things that, I'll just go back a bit further, I was fired for saying that there's not enough replication of the science, that we need to really test it to make sure it's right, and that when you do test this work for coming from these major scientific organisations, it's actually wrong.
Right.
And I got into trouble for that. Well, what happened out of the blue was a group of seven international scientists looked at the effect of climate change, the carbon dioxide concentrations on small reef fish. And they found that of these James Cook University studies, 8 out of 8 of the studies were completely wrong. So when the tests were done, they were found to be utterly, totally wrong. Now, my point about this is, well, who cares about little reef fish? Well, they are important, but the real point here is, what about all the other work that's coming out of these institutions? That hasn't been tested. It hasn't been checked. It hasn't been replicated. We are not checking this scientific evidence rigorously enough, And yet when somebody did go to do it, it wasn't Peter Reed, it was a group of people who totally believe in climate change and all the rest of it, but they were good scientists in the sense that they were totally happy to tell the truth when they find it. They found that this work was completely wrong. Very, very frightening in terms
of... What did the work relate to? Was it all the same? Were there separate issues? Oh, look,
some of it was initially completely crazy. Like, one of them was that increased carbon dioxide levels made fish lose their sense of smell. And apparently, fish can smell predators. And what it made them do, supposedly, was instead of swim away from the predators, it made them swim towards the predator.
That's not a good idea, I presume.
No, that's right. But it was completely wrong, complete rubbish. Another one was they lost part of their vision, and they lost this ability to automatically swim left or right as a school. But yeah, it was all just completely wrong. And this wasn't, you know, this was a group of very eminent scientists that went into this. One of the reasons they did it was that there's actually one of the JCU scientists was found in Sweden by the university there to actually be fraudulent. They have not been found to be fraudulent at James Cook University, but there is an investigation into that as well. We'll see how that goes.
Well, just speaking about your former employer, I think people would be interested to know, and you can say what you can. I know it's a matter that remains before the courts, but what's the situation? You mentioned earlier you were dismissed. And who took the action originally? Was that, did you take action for unfair dismissal?
Yes, so I was dismissed. We took action for unfair dismissal. We won 17 or 28, depending on how you count it, counts, awarded $1.2 million. I wanted my job back, but there was no way I could go back, so I was awarded. But James Cook University is now appealing, and so we're fighting that appeal. I've had to raise somewhere in the order of $800,000 worth of legal money from crowdfunding, and I've had to chip in about $300,000 of my own money to fight that battle, which we're doing now.
Well, good on you for having the fight. Do you still need people's support? We should.
My GoFundMe is running right at this instant, and I've got $15,000 to go, and we're going to get there in the next couple of days.
How do people contribute,
Peter? If you just Google GoFundMe Peter Reed, you should be able to finally get
GoFundMe
there.
Peter Reed, get on it and support this Australian battler, this Australian fighter. Now what? So at the moment, you won the first case, didn't you?
We won the first round, totally, 100%. Right.
But now you're appeal. And
that's
so
right.
And what's the timing of this then?
The appeal is on the 26th and 27th, I think, of May. James Cook University have hired one of the most eminent and expensive barristers in Australia. So it's going to be a little bit of a battle for us, but I think we're going to win.
Good on you. And how is JCU funding this? How do they...
Well, unfortunately, that's your guys who are funding that, Matt. So thank you for that.
Look, they're an independent organisation, so the problem with these things is once a government starts directing a university to one thing and then opens the... I'm mindful if we directed or tried to in this instance, what's stopping a future Labor government directing them in other directions as well? So but I do think... at a personal level, people out there should know in North Queensland and across the country that what should be an institution we should take pride in is currently devoting its attention to spend, what, millions, I presume? There'd be in the millions in legal costs, at least hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal costs to attack one of their former sites. How long were you employed at JCU?
30 years. 30 years I went to JCU. I had a 40-year association. Right. Look, the disgraceful thing is that I may be wrong on my views of the science, but they're views that are, you know, genuinely held, and I am an expert in some of the fields. I'm one of the few people who's going to bat for the farmers, basically saying, look, I'm just not sure this is all right, that what we're doing to the farmers is just not right. And James Cook University is the major far north Queensland university.
That's right.
And it's got rid of this scientist who's gone into bat for the science. And James Cook University is frankly not an asset to far north Queensland
attitude. Well, that's my concern here. As you say, you could be wrong, I am well used to people disagreeing with me. Yeah. In fact, I welcome that. It's part of the job I have. It's a battle of ideas, and people are welcome to have different ideas, different viewpoints. But my big problem with the society we're kind of living in at the moment is you've got to be part of the orthodoxy.
Yeah,
if you're not, it's probably, you know, if you're not part of the orthodoxy, some kind of Spanish Inquisition is unleashed on you. That then, what I'm concerned about, you might be able to give some insight to, is how does this affect other people? Like, you're obviously a fighter, right? You've steeled yourself. You've gone through probably hell, but you're getting through it. What I'm concerned about is how does this affect other scientists who might share some skepticism or cynicism like you do about certain results, but you know, you've got to, you can understand they might weigh up whether it's worth going away from the orthodoxy at risk of their own careers and peace of mind.
They can't. They self-censor. And I know a large number of scientists who may not, certainly wouldn't share all my views on the reef, and they may not think it's as minusculely damaged as I do, but I know a lot that have grave reservations about a significant fraction of the science that they're involved with. But they'll look at my case and see what happened to me. You know, I stood up and said, there's a quality assurance problem in that institution. He got fired. Everybody else looks at that and thinks, I'm not going to do that. And unfortunately, so we have this terrible problem in the scientific institutions that scientists can't actually say what they think, and that's a disaster.
Well, we've got to stand up for people having different views from us, and if we could just rekindle or recapture that sentiment in our society, we have a much better community, right? We're going to have much better ideas, much better outcomes if we can agree to disagree from time to time. So what do you think should be done here? Putting aside your individual case, what do you think is needed to help other scientists engage in proper, rigorous, combative debate?
We need to make sure that competitive debate is encouraged rather than discouraged. So I'm proposing, and I think it's in the National Party or the LNP, that we need an Office of Science Quality Assurance. So you take the scientific evidence that a government is using for its new policy or new regulation, and then you take that, and you subject it to really rigorous scientific checks to make sure it's correct. And if you give that as an opportunity for scientists to get involved, to actually become, you know, like a paid contrarian, they're going to stand up and they're going to do that, because that now is their job. Whereas at the moment, they don't want to be a contrarian because they see what happens when you be like that. So we need an Office for Science Quality Assurance that will do that job. Scientists are supposed to fight each other all the time, clash of ideas, but the reality is actually slightly different. What actually happens is that one side gets all the power and they exclude the other side. We've got to bring that ability to have a guaranteed fight, just like in a parliament. I mean, a parliament is just a guaranteed fight between two sides.
It's an adversarial system, yeah.
Yeah, we need to make sure that comes back into science.
The US Defence Department do this, don't they, with the red team, blue team.
Red team, blue team.
It's blue team, red team, isn't it?
That's right.
And
basically what happens in a military is that the top general wants to go and invade Poland or something, right? And now, you know, one of the underlings might say, that's a really bad idea, right? Really silly idea, but the general's going to say, well, you know, go back into your hole.
Off. Yeah, right.
But if you have a genuine... this guy's job is to tell the what might be the bad things that are going to happen.
Like devil's advocate, right?
Yeah,
devil's advocate.
Well, devil's advocate. You know, when the Roman Catholic Church still does saint people, you'd have the devil's advocate to make sure that you really got the right people.
So I suppose one question I have for you though is what would stop that organisation, captured?
Yes.
Being like, it's this who polices police. So if government funds another organisation,
right,
won't that just...
Well, that's why I think that the funding for that must be at least partly industry. So maybe 50-50 government. So government's going to introduce the legislation. It's going to affect the sugar industry. Well, sugar industry stump up a couple of million bucks. They now have a say that we can make sure that we appoint the right scientists who are more or less acceptable to both sides of the argument, so that this organisation doesn't get hijacked. But that is certainly the main concern with this whole idea, that you don't want it being hijacked.
Now, without opening up a can of worms, I did want to ask you one more question. It's a bit open-ended, but there is the issue of getting the best science, and... That must be done to make... It's a necessary condition to make good policy decisions, and that's what we're trying to do through the Senate inquiry. But I suppose there's also on top of that then, there are value-based judgments that must be made.
Inevitably.
About, you know, the benefits of farming and what it provides to towns like Tully, which are in here now, the jobs, the community, and the protection of the environmental assets. Because if you took it to one extreme, which is just not do anything anywhere with anything, but we obviously do, all of us do, even those radical, crazy greenies in the city, they're living in modified environments that have changed the landscape, well, mostly. So it's always a question of balance. How do we make those balanced decisions? Because my kind of view is we can't leave that just to scientists because they become value-based decisions and they need to be made, the trade-offs to be made.
They're made by the politicians. That's the job of the politician. And it's a different, totally different skill. But the politicians and the community need to be able to look at the scientific evidence and say, well, I'm sure that maybe it's a little bit wrong around the edges, but I'm going to trust that. What I'm saying is at the moment you can't trust that. So the community, because it's not checked, the community and the politicians then can't make those value judgment based on the best science because we actually, frankly, don't have the best science.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, those value judgment, that is a political thing and scientists should butt well out of it.
The problem we've got, of course, is that the politics can cut both ways. And obviously, in my view, and you don't have to comment on this, but the Labor Party have made a decision that for political reasons, they don't need the farmers, but they need the Greens' preferences and Green votes. So they'll trade off the impact here against what political benefit they can have in inner city areas. Whereas, you know, I, living in the reef area as I do, very regularly visiting areas like Tully, I can see the real world impact that these policies based on incomplete science, in my view at least, have on people. And I want the politics to go the other direction and say, well, people here need to be thought of. They need to be considered. And they're currently not in the political system.
No, true. But in my view, at the very bottom of this problem is the lack of the trustworthiness of the science. I actually have a degree of sympathy for the Premier, the Labor Premier, right? Because she believes the science.
We were going so well earlier. But anyway.
But because she the difference between me and her and you and her is that she trusts the scientific organisations, right? And essentially we don't. That actually is the difference. So she really believes that the reef is almost dead.
And
you can sort of understand it. What I'm saying to them is that the Australian Institute of Marine Science is an untrustworthy science organisation. It's better now than it was, but it still is untrustworthy because it has insufficient quality assurance. That is a heck of a thing to say. It's a heck of a thing for the average person to believe, right? They don't want to believe that because it's too horrible to believe it, but that essentially is what I am saying.
Well, my view, and I'll just put my own, my own view is we do have very good scientists
in this
country.
I totally agree.
And many good scientists who work for the CSIRO and AIMS and what have you. I'm more concerned about this groupthink mentality,
but this is the
which would not allow that debate. And I think that was exposed in the Senate this week.
When
I asked a very simple question about what the CSIRO had already written about climate change and bushfires, and it took an age for them simply to admit something because they knew by expressing that view in that forum in Senate estimates, it would potentially attract a certain amount of condemnation.
Right. Exactly,
and they could not speak the truth. Right. And that's what I'm concerned about. Not about their underlying integrity or ethics, but the pressures that they are facing.
Well, that's right. But this is where the quality assurance systems come in, right? So you've got excellent scientists down at AIMS, excellent scientists at James Cook University, but the system they're working in is broken, right? Mm. If you have a production line, you can have excellent workers, but if the system for ensuring the quality is broken, then you're going to produce rubbish at the end. You can have the best of people, but if they're in a bad system, and they are in a bad system, then we are producing science, which may be right, it may be wrong, we just can't tell. That's not good enough.
Well, Peter, we'll get to the bottom of all these issues. Thank you so much for joining us. As I mentioned, we are going to be back up here, or I'll be back up here in a couple of weeks with you. And if you're listening and concerned about the impact on the farming industry of regulations on sugar, on bananas, on cattle, please come along to these hearings because, you know, we need to have our voice heard up here. Sometimes we've just got to stamp our feet a little bit louder up here in North Queensland and have our voice heard. We're pretty good at doing that when we try. So hopefully we'll see people up here in 2 weeks' time. Thanks, Peter. And look, make sure you subscribe to our podcast, Weatherboard 9. You can find it on Spotify, Apple, iTunes, anything you like. Just search or go to weatherboard9.com.au. And great to have good, in-depth policy discussions with smart people like you, Peter. Thank you.
Thank you.